Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are cleaning up American discourse, one unethical persuader at a time. We see you out there. We're coming for you. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques, so we're trying to give you some of that. Up the game a little bit. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late night comedy writer from Hollywood, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I like to teach people rhetoric because they're like, what is rhetoric? Yeah, I know. So that's what this is all about. I have a different guest on every week. Sometimes we convert conservatives. Sometimes we just do wandering around a comedian's mind. And sometimes we have experts on here. I'd say this guy's a little bit of a mix of everything, our guest this week. Like, it's an interesting study in contrast. I know him kind of as an engineer, and I think that's his background, but he's done tech and tech sales. So he's in sales, but he comes across as a nice person. That's weird. And he's also does comedy. I don't know if he's actively doing it now, but he's been a stand-up and been around the comedy game. So I thought it'd be fun to talk to. So welcome his Geckness, Frank Geck.
Yeah, Dan, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it. It's quite an honor with looking at some of the guests that you have on here.
It is an honor, isn't it? That's what I'd like to bring to the just honor.
Just honor.
People think of me, that's what they think of.
Yeah.
Honorable. So run your background a little bit for people, yeah, just so we can orient to you a little bit.
Yeah. Well, if I went back to college, when I was in college, I wanted to be a stand-up comedian and started performing at the local club. And
you're Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, in Madison, Wisconsin.
You're as pale as it gets from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm up in the...
The cold north. I did it for a couple of years as an amateur, and one of my friends from high school, or one of the guys from high school who was really funny and wanted to be a comedian, came up a couple times and said hello, and he ended up very famous. So I went to high school with Frank Caliendo.
Frank Caliendo, everybody. Yeah. Oh man, he's got to be one of the top.
Yeah.
He's probably the top impressionist of all time.
Yeah. He's
Rich Little, fantastic. They'll throw that in there, but he's so much better.
He's phenomenal. So I went to a pretty funny high school. I think, you know, there were a lot of funny guys, and everyone had their thing going.
It's kind of a Northern thing too, right? That culture values odd characters and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. 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 You know, there was, another guy from my high school also. I forget his name offhand, but he was the big comedian in San Francisco doing politics in California. He had a club in San Francisco.
It wasn't Will Durst, was it?
Yeah, Will Durst was from my high school as well. So
really?
Yeah, just a
little. You know, Will Durst, you know what he's famous for?
What?
He's the only comedy show I ever paid to get into.
Oh, really?
I paid $8 to go see him at the Comedy Works in Tampa because... some reason I couldn't get in free that night, and it's always haunted me.
Yeah. Did he have a good show?
You know, I don't think, like, the way he does politics, it's not super hard hitting stand up. You know, it's more of a drifty wander. Like, I consider him more of a humorist than a stand up.
Yep.
Although he worked a lot of clubs. So it was a little light for me. I like a lot of, you know, hard punch.
Get it. Go. Yeah.
Stand up. But he was good. I mean, really, you know, interesting guy.
Yeah, I saw him perform once in Madison when he came through town. And so I don't remember him too well. But in Madison, we had this great guy, Dave Gray, who was this comedian. And he had this improv set that he did, which was a beatbox rap set, improv at the end of it. And people would give him some topics. And he would bring down the house every time. And headliners hated him because he had so much energy with that music and doing it. And but he could never go national because it was an improv set. You know, they just, like, nobody wanted to buy something that might be a little different, that might hit differently. So he was big in from Detroit to Minneapolis to Chicago. And so he was
a really good live act, but you just can't really. Yeah, it's tough taping that stuff, you know. And like with, do you remember Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah. With Drew Carey and those guys. Like, yeah. I used to go down the Hollywood Improv every Thursday night, and they would go down there and practice before they would tape. And so I'd hang out at the bar with him and give him all sorts of crap about, hey, I thought you guys were supposed to be spontaneous. Even up there practicing. But they were great. That,
yeah, the magic of the screen, the behind the scenes. I quickly switched into computer science after doing that. I was a marketing student and studied, you know, a lot about marketing is about rhetoric and about positioning and how do you convince people to buy something. And then just wanted to get more technical. Madison's a great technical university. You know, it's in that class of like the Georgia Techs and the, you know, there's a ton of amazing technical schools and Big Ten's good for it.
Super liberal school too, right? Isn't Madison's like one of the liberal cities in America?
Very much so. Very much so. And it's interesting, you know, Wisconsin kind of switches a little bit back and forth on each of the conservative to Republican. I ended up, you know, at that time choosing Democrat as my party. The thing that was, if we're talking about rhetoric, the thing that really convinced me was, why am I blanking on his name? But Bill Clinton's advisor who came up with the phrase, the economy, stupid.
What's his face?
From Louisiana, right?
I sat with that guy. Did I ever tell you that story? I worked with him. I did a thing called...
James Carville.
Yeah, James Carville. I did a thing called the... I was a writer for the Southern Sports Awards, which is a thing that nobody knows about, but all the Southern states have a little regional network, like 13 states, and they give out their own like ESPN awards. And so they have a show and it's just broadcast regionally, but he was the host. And so they hooked us up together so I could help him write, you know, some of the bits. And I sat down with him and he's like, what do you do? What now? And I'm like, well, I'm supposed to help you with some business. He goes, I'm not going to write anything. Let's just sit here and talk. Wow. I got to talk to him for like an hour. What a crazy dude he is.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. That
must Carvel. He's a character.
He sure is. He had a book just like, you know, explaining, outlining how he made a strong case in the book. I thought about how the economy in general did better under Democratic leadership, you know, whenever, the, you know, when he
There was a study that just came out. Was it last week that every Republican president has pulled the economy down and every Democrat has had to bring it back up?
Yeah. I haven't seen that one, but in Carville, yeah. Carville's was obviously to like 94 or 90 and, made that case. So I always felt that was pretty, if you talk politics, I was always pretty centric. You know, all my friends who are Democrats called me a crazy conservative. All my conservative friends called me a crazy liberal. So I think that's a sign of how you know if you're in the middle, right? Yeah. Is if each of your friends peg you as...
Neither side likes you.
Right, right. But after school, you know, I studied computer science. I got really lucky. I went out to Silicon Valley and joined this super cool startup, which was really one of the first examples or first publicly successful AI companies in the world. And it was Nuance Communications. And they, I got to write a lot of cool code and get really deep into coding and technology. And Nuance Communications is the first company to commercialize speech recognition. And they used it for IVR systems. So when you call on the phone and you say something, it'll understand what you say. It was a huge leap in technology and capabilities. The people I worked with were so unbelievably bright. Like we had this R&D team that every one of those guys was off the charts. And it was the type of place I walked around in the hallway wondering, you know, what am I doing here?
Constant imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. But they were also, you know, just, you know, it was the type of group who like, you could ask them any question. They didn't think it was stupid. You know, they were always like, they would consider it and think about it or, and so we built speech applications, the first, and a lot of those guys have gone on to places like Google and Verizon to run advertising programs and work in high tech. But there was one thing I found pretty funny. It's a little sad, but it was also funny.
Most of the sad things in life are funny, Frank.
when we were building the first speech system. Yeah. So we're building the first speech system for doing stock quotes, and it went live. And it was an elderly person who called in to get their stock quotes and ask about the stock quotes. And this was before anyone even knew speech systems were out there. And the system had a very narrow capability to understand what you said. It had to try to use prompts wording to direct you to something very specific to say. And if you went slightly out of bounds, you would get, it just wouldn't recognize you. And so if you said something like Microsoft, it would give you the stock. But if you said the stock Microsoft, it would fail because it's not listening for the stock, you know, at that time. So we would listen to recordings of people calling in. And one of them was of an elderly gentleman who clearly couldn't hear very well and just got in this loop against the computer where he would say, I want to know what Microsoft is. And the system would come back and say, I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. And he kept doing it and he didn't understand he was talking to a computer, but he also didn't give up. Like he was very persistent. And the tape went on for over 20 minutes him saying, and his wife's in the background, what is wrong with that person? I don't know what's wrong with these kids these days, you know? And so, so you'd hear a lot of tapes like that when you listen to these systems. You know, people didn't
That's
know.
That's kind of interesting though. Like, you know, with the AI and speech recognition, like I've talked to different people along the way of doing this project. Like Americans don't know how to argue. Like they haven't been trained how to argue. Like they consider like contradiction to be an argument, and that's not argument. Like contradicting what somebody has said takes nothing. Like all you're doing is just taking an opposite position. You're not thinking. And so like I've said there should be like a way of doing, you know, software that would train people how to do arguments. And if they do something like that, it would go, sorry, you can't do that. That's a simple contradiction, you know, try again. You know, because people literally don't know the pairings, you know, within argument structures.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. You know, you reminded me of something else that happened when I was working at Nuance in Silicon Valley. Stanford put on a little panel for about artificial intelligence and humor. And on it was... there was a philosopher, I forget his name, Marvin Minsky, who was the was either free software or the AI guy from MIT. There was a gal from Ireland who just got her PhD writing a computer program to write jokes.
Okay.
And Steve Martin. Those were the four people. And so the funniest was, the most amazing thing was the lady who got the PhD in writing jokes. She had her computer, she read all the jokes. And there were a specific form of word joke that you can use a dictionary for, but her program was only 300 lines of code, she said. And then she tested the audience to tell if you could tell which was a computer written joke and a human written joke. And this is 25 years ago. And the reason she got her PhD is because people couldn't know that, like the error rate of error, or the rate of guessing, just it was the computer wrote as good jokes for that type of word joke. Right. As human beings. And they were funny. They were 90% of them were funny jokes, like just quirks on a play of words. Like my son titles a lot of those. Like he'll say, why don't you get a parking ticket in space? Right. There's a lot of space, you know, like it may be that simple, but it's kind of those wordplay jokes.
Well, and that's what people don't really understand. You know, as a comedy writer, comedy writing is half intuition and it's probably 80% mechanics. Like knowing, like there may be, you know, 200 comedy writing structures, joke structures, and your brain just holds on to a few of them. And then you have the intuition of putting the right things in there. Like I've got a buddy who does one word replacement jokes and he's brilliant with them, but it's the only joke I've ever heard him write. So like an example would be in TV monologue writing, they give you a lot of times you crash two stories together in the joke. And so this was back when Bill O'Reilly, the news guy, had been accused of sexual harassment and they had tapes of it. And then Tara Reid, I think, was the actress who had just gotten into a crash, another cocaine-filled drunken crash, allegedly. And so the joke was, hey, you know, everybody gets on Bill O'Reilly for not being a good guy, but he sent, when he found out that Tara Reid got in a crash, he sent her a dozen long stem vibrators.
Right.
And so everything's the same, except for that last word gets replaced. But the intuition is knowing what's the exact right word and where to put it and all that.
Yeah.
But it's very mechanical.
Yeah. Yeah, and she figured that out, and it was just a brilliant thing. And then Steve Martin came up, and it looked like it was completely off the cuff, and did this 15 minutes where he made everybody cry laughing. Like, you know, you thought the computer was funny, and then seeing someone like Steve Martin, who's, you know, just an amazing performer, like he was making people cry. They were laughing so hard. So it was, your initial impression was like, oh my God, computers are taking over now. And then we were like, oh, thank God, we got people like Steve Martin who, there's really still a difference, but the difference has been changing over the years, obviously. But
yeah, so that's interesting. So you were there at the beginning of like the, what became Google Homes and Alexas and.
Yeah, a lot of the people who were at Nuance then headed out to Amazon and Siri and Google and worked on those assistants. I actually worked on some of the early assistants that didn't become, end up being commercial successes, like Motorola had an assistant they were working on. A lot of people went to work for a company called General Magic, which had a really cool personal assistant kind of thing.
You said General Magic, right? Not Genital Magic.
Yeah, General Magic. Yeah.
At first I heard, you were close to saying Genital Magic, but
that's right.
It was General Magic. So what do you think about that? Like, with all the Cambridge Analytica and all the tech, you know, stuff that's come up, especially in the persuasion and political field, like you're feeding into that, right? With that kind of, you know, linguistic, going into the linguistics of everything and sort of programming that out on people.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing what the technology, I'm not in that field anymore. But you know, one of the interesting companies that some people started out of who were in the NL space is this advertising company. And you know, when we were studying, if you think of an IVR tree, as you design what you say and what you want people to say back, you could sit in there with very much probably like joke tellers will argue about a single word and a single prompt for hours, like, you know, 3 hours, like Dennis should say, you know, and then they take sides. And so that you'd have these kind of arguments like that. And I was always a fan of, because I wasn't a user designer. I was like, I want to put 20 prompts in there and just see where we get the best compliance. Like, I don't care. Like, take 3 seconds and write each one, make it very Blink kind of Malcolm Gladwell and write them and look at what the best one is. Well, this advertising company did something even smarter. I don't even know why. I'm embarrassed I couldn't take that leap. You know, they built a system that will do 2,000 or 3,000. It does not A to B testing, but A to ZZZ testing. So they'll write 500 or 1,000 permutations. And if you have scale, they can run that in an advertising model. And then they can start looking at chunks of language and mixing them automatically using the system to write it. And so now, you know, people are getting ads that, you know, and then the way you can run it down a group, you can start figuring out what demographics these site phrasings work differently on, and you can start optimizing everything. And the results are huge. There's a huge ROI for doing this, you know, and even maybe even time of day or whatever. So, you know, when I was a marketing student, they said that only about 30% of people were susceptible to marketing, right?
Oh yeah.
There was this group, but today, everybody's, how do you compete? How do you mentally, there's this supercomputer generating millions of permutations of how to come at you and testing it against millions of people. And by the time that message comes to you, whether it's advertising or Facebook, everybody is getting hit by this. It's like a big gigantic machine working against you.
Well, it's fascinating because literally in the course that I, the first course that I wrote for that people can buy at Rhetoric Warriors is a master course in modern persuasion. And so essentially I just go and grab stuff from the past or stuff I'm going on now. And each week I'll write a different module about it. And literally this week I wrote about backward centric persuasion builds, which is what, you know, in rhetoric, you learn essentially that what you want to do as a persuader or what your skill set is as a persuader means nothing. The only thing that matters is what does this person need to hear in order to convert? And can you match that, you know? And that's when you said like 30% are not susceptible. Well, if you know enough information about them, everybody is susceptible to influence. Otherwise you're not alive. I mean, when you take in information as a human being, your brain evaluates it and you make a judgment. That's persuasion. But that kind of, you know, super information, starting with the super information to the consumer and then that working back in a, you know, a hard structured feedback loop to the message. Yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
At scale, you know, so you're getting millions of things running through it and judging it every second. You know, that's what people are dealing with today. You know?
That quantitative approach, you know, to figuring out what your messaging should be versus your qualitative intuition, like you're talking about the Steve Martin versus the computer program. You know, the Steve Martin just intuitive, like will make brilliant leaps in logic. It's called abductive thinking as opposed to deductive or inductive thinking. That's all inductive thinking. Massive amounts of data lets you get to deductive conclusions, and then you just apply that in a loop. Abductive is just like grabbing whatever and fusing it together in ways that don't make logical sense in an induction system. And so comedians are total abductive thinkers.
Yeah, there's math behind that. Actually, there's a whole science of math. I haven't seen it phrased in kind of with NL, but it's the type of problems that you have. There's this class of mathematical problems that humans can solve in an instant that a computer will take forever to solve. And so the interesting one there is, I don't know. I don't remember what class of problem chess is, but so that's basically the idea. There's, and it's been 25, 30 years since I took the class. I loved it, but it, you know, NP complete, and they can categorize. So what humans are is they're really good in this class of things they can do in one step that computers have to search a million years for, or a billion years for, to find the right answer. So
yeah, that makes perfect sense. And like, the theory I always combined it with, it was useful to me. It's like, there's a theory of cognitive complexity based on the image for it is ice cube trays. So like, you have stacks of ice cube trays inside your brain to organize information. And each one of those ice cubes trays is basically a word. So like Steve Martin, you know, he has an ice cube tray in my head, and everything Steve Martin goes into that ice cube tray, you know, so I know where it is and I can access it. And then way over here, you know, is Martin Luther, you know, who founded the Protestant church by nailing stuff onto a wall in 1340, whatever. But they both say Martin, you know? And so I can go, oh, Steve Martin nailing, you know, the comedy protest onto the wall of the Hollywood Improv and change, you know.
Yep.
But computers wouldn't do that.
No. Well, let me ask you this question, because when I was in Silicon Valley, a lot of my friends, had the belief that human beings were simply chemical computers, in a sense. I mean, have you ever thought about that? Or if you have, like, what do you think?
Well, basically, human beings can only think in terms of metaphor. Like Nietzsche has this great article called, or essay called, On Truth and Falsity in an Ultra-Moralistic Sense. And basically, his argument in there is that all language is metaphor. As soon as you say something, it stands for something else. It represents something else, which means it's a lie. It's not true. It's just a accurate representation or a useful representation. And so when human beings think of themselves as computers, or they think of computers as humans, it's just because we have the brain limit of only thinking in metaphor, you know? And so you'll be like, you'll find as much of the metaphor as fits. And then you're like, ah, but this part doesn't fit. You know, we can't be computers because we can be, you know, we're not programmable exactly like that. And you'll find the limits of the metaphor. And if the metaphor breaks down before you find it useful, you'll discard it. So this doesn't answer your question, or the fact that, no, we're not chemical computers.
Yeah. That's a good, I like the way, that's an interesting way to break it down. It's an interesting answer I haven't heard before. So
yeah, linguistics is interesting when you start to match it up with tech. Because most tech people haven't had, you know, a big background in linguistics, and linguistics is all just a series of code. Yep. I mean, it's literally, you know, and some people will say like language is a virus, that it's a virus that human beings were infected with, you know, way back in our history. And now we transfer it to each other. Like, you can see people doing it with babies. They get in their face and they go, goo, 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 goo. And that's transferring the virus of language.
Well, that's, you know, computer technology is, I mean, a large core of it is linguistics. I mean, all computer programming languages are a specific language that have a specific defined format and grammar structure that you can do it. And so when I was working in the speech industry, you know, that's what they're talking about. Nobody was able to come up with a grammar that completely represents English, like, and how do you do that? And then how do you make a computer deal with it if you can't build a grammar for it? And so there's all these techniques that are workarounds because there is no way. And obviously English is changing on a day-to-day basis. Though my mother, who is an English teacher, wouldn't like to hear that. But on a day-to-day basis, it is. It's a different language. So how do you keep it up to date and how do you know? And so, when you're studying computer science, people may take a compiler class where they actually write a program that will look at a specific language you can create and convert it into machine code. And so somebody writing Java or C++ compiler, or, you know, they're not all compilers anymore, there's interpreters, but PHP and everything, those are all defined languages, you know. So language actually comes, you know, that's, you know, and then I worked with the language in IVR and speech recognition. But yeah, language does come through a lot. And a couple of our PhDs were computational linguists who got into Silicon Valley. Some were just pure math guys, very statistics-based. Markov model type stuff, which is how that was done 25 years ago.
They weren't rhetoricians, were they?
We only had one Russian at the time. And he says his dad didn't work for the KGB, but I'm not so sure.
Did you hear Russian? I said rhetorician.
Oh, how many rhetoricians? None. We had a lot of user interface designers, but we didn't have anyone who was a rhetorician or had a communications degree.
Yeah, so. I always tell people, like, when you learn rhetoric, you become this sort of a linguistic assassin, because it gives you all these techniques, like semiotics and linguistics study the grammar structures and things like that. But rhetoricians will study that stuff, but then they come into it like with missiles and just blow it apart for their own purposes. Like, if I know you're running on a certain grammar, if I know you're running on a certain logic and an argument strand, that means I can predict your mind.
Yeah.
And once that is in place, then I can do whatever I want to disrupt that.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, people get nervous about rhetoricians, because, you know, we study all the different systems that are going on and just figure out what bot can we create that will adapt and get us what I want from that person.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think that area of natural language high tech is ready for you now. Like 25 years ago, the problem, you know, even if you had a user interface designer, it was still like, what stock would you like to buy? Please say only the stock name, you know. But now with the Siri and the stuff like that, I mean, that's and dialogue management tools, and how do you understand how people are flowing through a conversation? That's the tough spot right now. And that's what the technology is ready for, exactly what you described. How does a computer walk itself through understanding that? I mean, Siri and Amazon and Google Home, I don't use Google very much. The kids use Amazon, and I use Siri every once in a while on the phone. They're still very kind of one-step computer interactions. There's no dialogue management really in there. But that's an area, it's very hard to do. And that's exactly what you're hitting on. I mean, that's where the tough problems are, and it's ready for people like you.
My daughter gets mad at me because I'm mean to Siri. You know, when it says something, it talks too long. I'm like, hey, I don't need to be your friend.
Yeah.
You know, just do what I told you. She's like, don't be mean to her. I'm like, I can totally be mean to her. There's nothing on the line here.
Well, you know, these systems, one of the ways they work is you feed them millions of sound samples, and they categorize the sound samples. Now, someone's vocal tract changes from when they're three to when they're an adult. And so a lot of the systems don't train very well. I'll have a lot of kid data, right? So, and when I was at Nuance, you would work hard. You would constantly retrain the models based on the people who are using it. So whoever's using the system, you'd automatically be building back into the system, right? And then they did more intelligent, I'm sure they do more intelligent stuff now where they like, no, they've listened to you enough and they keep even, you know, building up something, a profile for you. But so for Amazon, you know, a five-year-old kid doesn't get recognized really well and they can't deal with it very well. So it's just like the screaming level and Amazon trying to deal with it it just goes off the charts. Like, the kids go ballistic when they want.
Well, you know, the nice thing is, like, it's approximating human interaction, So you should be able to do, you know, it's just like with cyborgs or anything else, like it goes to Westworld. You can do anything you want to that technology, you know, it, and I should be able to program it so that if I have an argument with Siri or whoever I want to name her, like you should take your ex, name it your ex's name.
Yep.
And then whenever you make a good point, it goes in her voice, it'll say something like, man, that is, you're really, you're right. I'm totally wrong on this. I am so sorry.
Yeah.
Be very satisfying.
Yeah. I haven't thought that's a good new one. I like that one. That's that would sell. People would.
Yeah. Right. You know, like
to hear your spouse or
your... to you, like your boss, just program their name in there and just say whatever you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, when I was there at the early days of Nuance, we had somebody call up who wanted to get the first deep fake. So all of my friends that a lot of the people who worked there in the PhD group, they went to amazing universities, but a bunch of them went to Cambridge in England, and they were English. And they had friends who were working on the first deep fake. So like how to listen to a couple things that you say and then have the system speak using the same phonetic tones that you use in the different parts of the world. So somebody called us once and they wanted to buy one of those vocalizers that, you know, you call the FBI to get your ransom money. And they also wanted the deep fake. So they wanted to sound like, I'm like, shouldn't we call the FBI that somebody just called us for this stuff?
Some kidnapping software.
Right. I need the kidnapping voice module.
Yeah.
They didn't exactly say that, but so.
Can you get it to me in the next 2 minutes?
Right. The other interesting thing, I thought was going on there was, so speech recognition came out of DARPA, which was, you know, the defense research program. And when a couple of the guys came back from a conference once, and they're like, you know, the way DARPA did it is when they build a big project, they give funds to each, like 40 universities, each to do a little bit of the project,
right,
thinking they're keeping it secret. But when they show up at the conference and everybody tells what their little piece is, gosh darn it, if these PhDs can't figure out what the whole program is, you know? So one conference they came back and they're like, oh, it sure sounds like the government's building a massive phone system to listen to everybody's conversations. Oh, well, I guess that's what speech is for. So Snowden wasn't too much of a surprise, I think, to a lot of people who were at those conferences, but.
Well, it gets all that stuff, right? I mean, are you on Clubhouse? Do you know what Clubhouse is?
No.
So Clubhouse is kind of the latest social media app that has not quite risen to the surface everywhere yet, but it's essentially, it's all voice. It only works with iPhones right now, but you sign up and people will host basically like panel discussions. They call them rooms, but you can go in and listen to somebody else's conversation. And there may be 500 or 1,000 people listening to two or three or four or five people talking. And you can raise your hand in the room. And if they call on you, then you get to go on stage and talk as well. But it's kind of interesting because I keep trying to go on there. And I mean, it's you know, Gilgamesh right now. It's Babel. It's China and it's India and it's everything in one place.
Yeah.
And so you go on there and I haven't really found anything that I can sit there and listen to because, you know, I ascertain really quickly about whether I'm interested in these people, whether they're smart enough for me to listen to, because listening is harder than just watching something in the background. Like your brain can't just passively listen if it's not music, you know, if there's a conversation going on, your brain will pick out words and suddenly you can't do anything else.
It's very jarring.
But it is fascinating. You ought to check it out because it's literally just talk and trying to, and you can go into the room and you can find other people in the room that do similar things that you do. It's good for sales, actually.
Yeah.
You know, you ran a panel on the beginnings of AI or, you know, voice recognition.
Yeah.
Then if people were in that industry or something, they could come in there and listen and then contact you like through Instagram or something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I'm glad I've checked that out. Yeah, a lot of what's happened in the last 20 years, like Clubhouse, it's, you know, it seems like there's just this massive evolution of what message boards and how people used to jump on the AOL. Like even Facebook, I think, is just an evolution of that in a sense, making it more accessible and better network and whatnot. So that that sounds like a cool take. I bet it sounds like it'll get its stuff shaked out and figured out and it'll be a useful kind of thing.
Yeah, Elon Musk was on it last week, so it sort of blew up into everybody's consciousness a little bit. So yeah. Usually when guys like that start wandering over there, they've already owned, you know, part of it. And
you know, right.
He's an immediate lightning rod into, you know, exposure in the media and all that kind of good stuff.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that's, you know, so that was the early stage and then ended up getting into sales. You know, I was really a software developer, got into sales.
Now, why did you do that? Why did you switch out of, you sound like you really liked writing code. Why'd you jump over to sales?
I did. I liked writing code a lot. I felt like you become your job. So if you sit there for 12 hours a day writing code, you become very introspective. You know, does the, it, which is first, the nerd or the introvert, you know, like, it, you know, so you, if you program 12 hours a day, it's just ends up socially isolating. I didn't feel like you had an easy way to move up a company or go do different things in the company. And then also things started getting outsourced to China and India for programming. So people were, you know, telling you that your job was worth $40 an hour, right? And I was like, I should have gone into plumbing, right? Which is, you know, isn't the case. You know, there was just a 3-year shift there where that was a kind of a hard shift. But I started a company with some friends, which did reasonably well, but not enough for everybody to stay engaged. And so after that shift, I got a great offer to be a sales engineer and went back and did it. And I got really lucky because I worked with some amazing teams as a software engineer. And we had some great success selling, you know, tens of millions of dollars of software to companies. We closed two of the largest deals in the company's history at that time. And then just slowly moved more onto the sales and business development side.
Talk about that, like tech sales, software sales, and this kind of stuff that you're talking about, like selling into that environment. Like, what are some of the things that you've extracted from there as, you know, lessons?
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, I used to do door-to-door newspaper sales. I did in the summer for my uncle's company, you know.
Like knock on the door and try to get a subscription?
Yeah, right, right. And I ran some crews doing that. And so I was kind of start there, you know. When, you know, there's if you look at the history of like how people teach people to do sales, the content from 20, 30 years ago is, or 40 years ago is very, you know, I want to say I'd go far manipulative base, you know, like how do you walk people down a garden path where they can't say no? Like, I'm going to keep asking Dan a series of yes questions that are all, you know, where you just can't say no at some point, you know, that's one technique, you know? So they have like little tricks like that. In technical sales, at least the stuff I've been doing with larger price items, it's never been, the sales process is different. It's really about, you know, first of all, are you selling something you believe in? Because people understand that or not. It doesn't necessarily that you sell the perfect product. You may believe in the company and our product will get there. It might be a little behind right now, but I believe in the product. But first you should be selling stuff you believe in. I don't see people who are successful who aren't. And then the second thing is really matching customer needs to what you have, like listening to your customer. The best salespeople spend a lot of time listening to their customer. They may not be able to fulfill everything that their customer wants, but the big thing is matching it up. Matching up what their customer wants to what you have and why, right? So there's a lot of then, once you understand what they need, explaining how your product meets it and making sure they understand it. There's a lot of de-risking the product for a customer. You know, a lot of people have their
I like that word, de-risk.
Huh?
That's a good word, to de-risk things. That's a good approach in life. I'm going to de-risk this online date for you.
Yeah, right. Well, that's why you meet in a public place that's safe, right?
Right. Or, that's why, like, I mean, there. It's funny, like, the different techniques people have for this. Like, I talked to one woman online who made me show her a picture of something that I was make me take a picture of me holding something up. She told me what to hold up. It's like a salt shaker. She goes, now hold this up and take a picture of yourself and send it to me. And that proved I was who I was, you know, and she was in charge of it, but didn't give any way information of me. But yeah, so that was de-risk.
Yeah, exactly. That's she exactly didn't know right.
I'm a salt shaker killer.
So de-risking things is very huge. And one of the ways you do that is rhetoric, right? Telling stories about how other customers are using your product. A lot of what people want to understand are who else is using it and how and why, right? So that's a lot of what you do. And then there's just a simple fact. It's kind of de-risking also, but the fact is, are you going to take care of this person, right? So in the big, and it all depends on the size of the deal you're doing, right? If I'm selling a $10,000 deal, you don't do all this. But when you're selling a $500,000 or $3 million deal, you know, we would be at the customer site 2 days a week, you know, 2-3 days a week, you know, we'd be taking them to dinner and things like that. So that's big, you know, and then there's the economic side, the numbers side. So you're like, you know, does it fit and match, but then what are the economics behind it? And so that's one of the things I spend a lot of time on is what is the economic model behind what you're buying from us? How long will it take to pay off? What's your cost? What are your total costs to run it? Why are we a better value than any other people? Where are they going to get from, you know, from us versus a competitor? So, you know, what I found is most people, they don't know your product and what it does as well as you do. So when salespeople leave that model to them, like often salespeople be like, well, they're going to build this justification for buying our product and go give it to the team. Like whenever you have the opportunity, you should build that model for the customer because you know all the details. And so that was one of the things I brought to the table is the ability to get really good financial models around why they're buying what they're buying and stuff like that. So
that's interesting. So do you split those roles in the sales? Like do you have the finance people like in Hollywood? One of the techniques that they do when they negotiate with talent, for example, or, you know, companies when they're doing new productions is like the showrunners or the people, the principals will make an agreement with the talent, be like, yeah, we definitely want to work with you. We love what you do. You know, it's the old Hollywood, everybody's in love with everybody. What a wonderful world it is. And then be like, okay, now we're going to hand you to business affairs. And business affairs is the castle of money that they don't want to pay anybody, right?
Right.
So that's why you have to have a manager and usually an agent who are your, you know, knights in shining armor that can go in and bash down the castle and pull out some of the dragon's money. Because the castle does not want to give away that money. But they don't want to do that with the talent because that ruins the relationship with the talent.
Right.
And so like literally the best way to do it is the talent doesn't know what the money is because they'll get disappointed. You know, and then they're not as good creatively and it's just a bad system. So they really separate those worlds.
It's not completely as separate, but it's close. So when I was a sales engineer on the large accounts, I considered it technical sales. You were a technical salesperson. You know, if I'm selling a $10,000 deal with somebody, I do speed and feeds and off I go. That's a typical sales engineer. Like, how does it work? And I'm done. And the salesperson does everything else. On large accounts, the salesperson in the early part of the sale would often find the money, help justify where the money is. They would also connect different organizations in these huge companies like an AT&T or something, you know, she'd tell that groups what we're doing, but they'd often find where the money is and help find the budget. Like I know Bill as VP, he has a budget for something, right? And you can get, because it fits under this program, Steve, you can use a little bit of Bill's budget. I'm sure it'll work out because this Bill wants us as well. So they do a bit of that. In that part, I wasn't doing anything, but as soon as it got handed over to every large company has a procurement organization and there are people who are just trained to negotiate. And that's all they do all day long. And each company is different. Some are, you know, win at all costs. Some would say they're win at all costs and were very reasonable, more than reasonable. And you could do a deal quickly. But usually at that point, you know, I would own that part of the process of the final negotiation. You know, what are the final terms on the contract? And that's different for every company. You know, some sales engineers don't write any contracts, but for me, back in the day, that's what I was doing. I would do that negotiation with the procurement team. So then they would play hardball, right? They would act like there's no business value. We're, you know, you go through these levels, in interest, the business team buys, it makes a business decision, goes to finance, he approves it. So, and then you go to the negotiation, right? So each time, if you, when you're new, you think you won the deal. Oh, the business team said, we got it. We're done. No, you got to now, they got to pass. And every company has a different process. And that's part of the scale of someone leading a sales team with large companies is learning what the sales process is for that company, how they budget, what the cycle is, who do I have to connect in? How can I help move that along and grease the wheels by going to communicate with people when, because they're not talking internally. But yeah, so that you think you're done with the negotiation and you really have like 3-4 levels of negotiation. So.
Well, and that, brutal. That goes back to the earlier thing about really getting information about your target, you know, getting that kind of depth of information about each company. And then you having a generalized experience of what it's like to go through with companies, you know, in a generic right. sense, and knowing, you know, where the typical sticking points are and probably being able to fairly quickly figure out what you're dealing with because you've done it before.
Right.
You know, so that, you can avoid, like you said, you know, burning all your energy on that first, you know, first level and then not having anything left.
Right.
By the time you get down to the actual, you know, decision maker.
You know? Yeah. And so since being a nuance, I went to a bunch of startups. And so in that cycle, if a lot of startups, there's very few kind of, where I wouldn't say very, more startups focus on kind of the new social media or kind of mass market type things. That's their dream, is that they can scale up without a sales team. The few times I've been in smaller companies with an enterprise sales organization, those executives don't understand that process and it takes a while to explain it. But also they don't even, often don't even understand how large companies budget, right? So you could go in with a cool idea and go, AT&T wants to buy it, but you just passed their budget cycle this year and you may not make it in the next budget. And they are, in their mind, they're slotting you in 2 years in advance. So like, we love it. We want to buy it. You know, okay, great. Then they don't talk to you for 6 months. Why not? You know, they're, and then can we try to get, you know, so often startups will, with really good news and good feedback, you know, accelerate what they think they're going to sell. And there's really nothing, it's very hard to get in between those budget cycles. The best salespeople I've worked with get in there and find the money then at that point, right? So they get in there, figure out who has a little extra money towards the end of the year, or who has money to spend, and they'll make something happen. So that's the game, but that's
so a tough thing. Like you're not just persuading, you're then going into their process and helping them, you know, navigate, like you said, moving cash around to be able to pay for it. Like I know with marketing builds, you know, for the 500 Rockets marketing agency, you know, we would go into these companies, you could see what they needed to do, right? Like from an architecture perspective, what they need to put into place. And usually it was fairly big because you need a robust marketing architecture to really make a dent, you know, especially for these smaller companies and what they wanted to do. And they would be like, well, we've got like, you know, $10,000. And I'm like, well, that's the first week.
Yeah.
What else you got? But it was really a construction project. Like nobody would go to a home builder and say, I want a $500,000 house or a $2 million house, but I don't have financing. I don't have any money.
Right.
But they come to marketing, right. You know, without any, you know, money or financing. I'm like, well, really, we need to be also a lender.
Yep.
Right. Like marketing agency and lender.
Right.
Because that's what the, you know, builders end up doing. They just make deals with the banks and, you know, so they can get the money for the people.
Right.
And so like, it was all the time. Like everybody's like, oh, we need a website. We need, you know, videos. We need that. I'm like, great. They're like, well, we have no budget. I'm like, yeah, you wouldn't do that anywhere else.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting about tech marketing. In my opinion, you know, I was a marketing student at Madison and they were really took a bunch of courses from this company, which was a boutique marketing firm in Madison. It was a guy who had been an executive in New York and wanted a smaller firm, started in Madison. And he had like 3 clients. It would be Coca-Cola, GM, and Clorox or something, right? So we had these three major clients, and they had this huge process and understanding around marketing. And this, they had obviously an account team and a creative team, and the account team was very data-based, very kind of, how do you test stuff? What is the optimal message? How am I doing the top two messages or in the category? How do I, you know, they went into all this stuff, and I've never seen any marketing, any tech company I've done do it. But the one that came closest is one of the last companies I was at, a smaller company. They did a content-based marketing approach, very similar to Vaynerchuk. It was unbelievably successful. Like I haven't seen any tech company really go after kind of something more than, you know, we do trade shows, we do some light blogs, we do this, but the results were so good. Even when I describe them to people, if they go and step it a little further, what you can get, nobody believes it in the tech world. Nobody, because nobody's seen it really work exceptionally well. And it's hard to sit, you know, get them to understand what happens when it works. So,
yeah. And it's the same thing, like with the thing that Matt created with the living libraries of just doing, you know, massive libraries of great tech answers.
Right.
Just the amount of exponential growth from that stuff is insane. You know, but again, these are things that, because people, you know, stay on the house metaphor, people go into a neighborhood and they're like, I want a ranch house, or I want a two-story Craftsman. And that's the only thing they've got in their mind. You're like, well, we can build you a series of ascending tents, you know, that spin in the air and that have a, you know, a hang glider effect. Right. You're like, what? Like, no, people love them, but you know, because nobody's used to seeing those structures, it's just they don't think in those terms.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole trick of it is how do you, when people are so locked into a mindset, how do you communicate clearly in a way that, because it's, you know, and it's got to be concise because they don't want to spend time thinking about it. You have to find a way to be extremely short and quick with that. And
that's why, you know, in the course that I started with, that's the basically persuasion in the modern era, modern persuasion, because you're persuading into a culture where everybody's busy. Everybody's got a million things to do. Everybody's got 1,000 things to think about. And you're trying to, you know, pop in there with some type of vibrancy that'll get, you know, some attention and some movement, you know, some effect on their brain. You start to see why guys like, you know, Trump and the sort of really hardcore politics is effective, because it's just so loud, you know, it's so vibrant, it's so constant. It can cut through all of that, you know, muck and actually get to people's heads.
Yep.
And everything else, if you're reasonable and you're, you know, and you're talking, you know, nothing, it doesn't get anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, you're competing against that's out there in the world. You know, how do you, and how does it reinforce your brand if you're shocking, or how do you do it in a way that, I think what made the team successful at ours is they spent a lot of time doing education. So there was value for people to come look at it. So about 80% of the stuff was just education about the market, and then 20% was about the company. So people would come because they started to trust that they could learn something, and that built the trust effect with the company. So, it's hard to also tell your executive, like, I think we should be building content that's more than about stuff than just about us. Like, what? You want to, you know, so, but yeah, that those changes are coming.
Well, I think, you know, that's one of the things I've always had trouble with in marketing, coming from rhetoric and sort of doing marketing the last 5 years, is marketing's, it sends out valueless content. You know, and people don't want to see valueless messages anymore. It doesn't matter, even if it's like a YouTube clip of something like a crazy cat. Like, I followed a Twitter thing yesterday of cats in places, cats where they shouldn't be, I think was the, and it's just like the first one was a cat sitting on the side of a wall where there's a seal, like a little seal, like in a zoo. And the seal's like looking at the cat, and the cat's looking at the seal, and then the cat just whaps the seal. And I'm like, that's funny. You know, I don't know why, but the cat shouldn't be there with a seal.
Right.
So it finds that little niche that you're like, okay, I would look at this a few times, and probably one out of every 10 is going to be like, oh, that's pretty cool. Or how'd that happen? But it's content that's got value, even if it's entertainment value, information value. If you can offer people information that they need in that moment, especially in the tech world, that is a killer marketing strategy.
Yeah.
because they'll come back there because you are solving a problem and saving them time and clicks and mistakes. And yeah, it's super powerful.
Yeah.
But yeah, costs money to do that stuff.
Yeah, it does. It does. And to do it right. So.
Well, this is cool, man. I don't want to hold you too long because I know you got to, you know, work. You got to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get paid. Can't do podcasts all day long.
Yeah.
But thanks, man. Like I said, I knew you'd have interesting stuff to say.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, I don't know why it didn't hit me earlier that there was a closer tie to kind of my history and what you're doing around rhetoric with the tech stuff. But yeah, this has been a very interesting conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's why I said rhetoric's kind of a sneaky ninja. Like, it turns out everybody does it. Like, everybody's always designing their messages to try to have an effect on who they're talking to, but they don't get formal training in it. So when they see that there's formal training, they're like, oh, I could have been a better ninja all this time.
Well, you know, when I was in high school, I played sports, a lot of sports, but my brother played less sports and did debate. And I think he took second in the state on his team for debate, right? And now he's a doctor. And I mean, I think his whole life, he's had this huge strength on the ability to first, you know, often in the debate competitions, you have to grab information, process it quickly, and argue it, right? And so, and then how he, you know, just that practice and learning how to communicate with patients concisely or effectively about what their issue is and why and what the choices are, right? You know, I think it's been a huge advantage for him, and I'm still talking football a little bit.
But your talk's more fun than that doctor talk, just because it's effective in learning about human beings so that you can help them.
You'd still be in the waiting room waiting to talk to him. So.
For sure. All right, man. Well, cool. Again, I appreciate it. Any message, anything what you want people to go look at that you do, buy something from you?
No, I don't have anything to buy or check out, but I appreciate the interest. If people are interested in the natural language space or AI, stuff like that, and want to ask a question, I'm on LinkedIn, Francis Geck or Frank Geck on LinkedIn, and feel free to connect with me. I use LinkedIn for a lot of my professional communication and networking. So I'd love to connect.
Awesome. Well, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there. Do some change on people. Don't hold back. They need it. They need your help to think the right things instead of the wrong things. That's why we're here. We'll see you next time.